Hi, my name is Jordan. I am a special education teacher from the UK. I share my passion for everything communication, sensory regulation, and fun lesson ideas for my classroom of disabled pupils aged 4 to 11. Each week, I am joined by experts in the field, answering your questions and sharing our knowledge and experience working alongside our beautiful young people. Let's get started. Hey everybody. Today is going to be all about early years. I'm going to be joined by Hayley from All About Early Years, and we're going to be talking about the SEND provision and how to support your SEN children in early years. Now, I haven't actually heard from Hayley today, so if she doesn't turn up, then we'll just work with your questions and I'll do my best to answer them. And if she does turn up, then awesome, we can answer them together. I was really excited to speak to Hayley because my school is specialist provision, but we're attached to a mainstream school. And it's becoming so obvious that so many teachers, whether they're mainstream or not, are SEND teachers now. There's some incredibly complex and high support needs in mainstream, especially on those early years, nursery, reception, year one, because the EHCP process is taking so long to get through that these children are in those early years and key stage one classes before they get to specialist provision. It's very rare now that children will get it, you know, before they start school, which means that all you lovely early years teachers and key stage one teachers and nursery teachers are having to manage children with needs that you haven't been trained for or seen before. So I'm hoping that we can work together and support you in this today. And also, I want to be making sure that I'm giving fair, realistic and good advice. So let's have a look at how to set goals for non-verbal children with echolalia. So I assume these are like IEP goals or targets. So I would look at, I have a free blog post all about the stages from echolalia all the way through to actual catching up with developmentally and speech with their peers. There's stages to that, and I've got a free blog post all about it on my website. If you head to my website and search Gestalt, G-E-S-T-A-L-T, then you will find my free blog post all about the stages. It says what to look out for so you can see what stage your child is at, and it says how to support them. And then maybe you could check where your student or where your child is on the stages, and then you could have a look at what the next descriptor is that they're working towards, and then set some targets around that. For example, maybe if they're at stage one and they are echoing directly what they hear straight away, you know, when they hear it, well then stage two is to have a delay before echoing that phrase. So maybe their target would be to have a 20 second delay after hearing a phrase, and then it might be having an hour delay, a 2 hour delay, you know, making it realistic. And then your, how you achieve that would be you modeling and using those phrases in context for other purposes, you showing objects to do with that phrase and kind of make it meaningful, and understand your child's meaning behind that phrase as well. If it's quite emotive, maybe they're trying to share that emotion. If it is about a certain object, maybe they're requesting it or seeking something similar. So that could be a target around, echolalia. And it does happen on the child's terms, but it's really great to be able to measure where they're at, because then you can look out for what's next. Because the interesting thing about Gestalt language processing is it looks like they're taking a backward step as they're progressing through it, but they actually are progressing. So it's really important that you know the stages. And I say that because, so let me explain what I mean by that. So often their speech seems really quite great because they're copying exact phrases. So they'll be grammatically correct, they'll have inflection, they'll be emotive, you know, they'll be really great sentences. However, as they work through the stages, they will be adding words and creating words on their own without it being from a TV program. They'll add their own ideas onto it. Now, often they are not grammatically correct, but that still is a step forward because they're creating them themselves. But sometimes parents will say, well, they've gone backwards, you know, they used to be able to say all these beautiful phrases and now they can't anymore. But it's actually because they're they're creating them themselves. So for example, a great example of this is one of my students loves the Gruffalo and has lots of echolalic phrases, so exact phrases. But I knew he'd reached this certain stage of being, you know, and stepped forward, because he said when the Gruffalo was holding up the mouse and he spun him around, he said, Gruffalo spinned mouse around. And I knew that he hadn't heard that from anywhere else, because I knew that that wasn't grammatically correct. So he must have created spinned or spunned, I think it, he said, himself, which was really exciting. But it's only exciting to me because I knew what the next stage to look for was. Whereas otherwise, if I hadn't have known that, I would have thought, you're going backwards, you know, you used to be able to say that word really well. So yeah, definitely look at the stages on my website about Gestalt language processing. Okay, next question. We are waiting on Ofsted. How do you set an early years classroom up with the high level needs we have? That is such a great question, and a really great question for Hayley. I hope she comes on soon. As far as Ofsted with SEN though, I can speak for that. We had Ofsted last December, and genuinely, they want to, if they see a behaviour live in the classroom, they will want to see that reflected on their behaviour plan. Or if it's a new behaviour randomly that day, they'll want to see you logging it, or what you're doing about safeguarding, and as far as recording that, just as you would all the time. As for their learning, they loved that my class learned in parallel with mainstream subjects. So when mainstream were learning about Vikings, we were learning about all about me and all about our history and our family. Or if they were doing about a certain, like nurses, for example, like nurses in World War II, we were learning about emotions and how to request help and how to say what's wrong or say what we're feeling. You know, they were linked and they really liked that. So if you have SEN and high level, high support needs in your class, then try and think outside of the box. What does this target or skill look like for them to make it meaningful? And then go off of that. Luckily, I've done all the hard work for you. My sensory curriculum is literally that, because I had to create a curriculum from my mainstream school's curriculum for my sensory learners. I literally took all of the subjects, all of the topics, all of the breakdown from the national curriculum that they used, and I broke it up into making it suitable for my sensory learners. That's £10 on my website. So hopefully that helps as far as Ofsted goes. And support your teaching assistants as well, because they'll feel incredibly watched and observed, especially if the child's having a difficult time or going through a crisis. I know a couple of mine became dysregulated just because there was a visitor in the room, you know, and they're feeling my fear and anxiety. So just reassure the teaching assistants that they know the plan, like go through what to do. If that happens, then do this. If that happens, then do this. Just so they feel reassured and, yeah, not judged on the day. So they're making some sensible and well thought out judgments on what to do. How do we do continuous provision in a safe way? Yeah, lots of children in my class have trajectory schemes of play. Super dangerous. Yeah, lots of throwing. So I find that continuous provision can be really overstimulating for sensory learners and autistic learners. Typically, autistic learners are incredibly visual learners and they take in everything all at once at the same time. So if everything is out on show, it can be really overwhelming and really heightening, and then they get overexcited and then make some unsafe decisions like throwing, tipping, pouring, messing things up, tearing, all of those kind of things. So a really good way, if you've got SEN in your continuous provision classroom, I use dividers, so wall dividers in my room, to make them a safe section that doesn't have anything on the dividers. So it is, you know, clutter free in a way. Not that your classroom is cluttered, but it might look like that to them. It might look, there's lots of things around. Another way is, rather than having see-through boxes, you could have clear boxes, or having little curtains that go across your shelving rather than it all being on show all at once. So just, yeah, being really mindful of, you know, what does this look like visually for my learners that get visually overstimulated, without taking it away from your other learners. I know that this is incredibly complex because continuous provision has such great value for so many reasons. But just be mindful of where you're positioning your autistic children in the classroom. I often go for corners or edges so that there's nothing happening behind them, because that can cause anxiety and overstimulation. So have them by the wall in the corner with dividers in between, and then they can choose when to go out and when to come in and when they need that break away from the busyness of the room. And then also, if you wanted things out, just be careful what you have out. Maybe if you have children that eat things or like to cut things, you know, maybe actually the children have to ask for the scissors or ask for the blue tack or the Play-Doh rather than having those out. And I know it feels like a shame, because I know we have this wonderful idea of having a Pinterest classroom, but actually how things are going now with such high needs in your classroom, it just might not be safe, and that has to come first. So it might be that you have a visual on the tough tray or on your table that the children can use to ask for what they need. So they're still showing independence, they're still choosing to go to the areas, but it's just making it a little bit safer for those learners and taking the burden away from the teaching assistant that's trying to manage and keep that child safe and everyone else around him safe. How to teach a child to walk straight with vestibular sensory issues. So it is about teaching them, and they might have a physio plan, I suppose, but also if they have vestibular sensory seeking needs, it's about meeting those needs. So vestibular, for those that don't know, is your balance sense. It's linked with your inner ear, and it helps your body to know if you are upright or upside down or a bit wobbly and a bit unbalanced. Those with vestibular seeking needs can be one of two things. If they have a heightened vestibular sense, then they would be incredibly seeking of it, which means they're your upside down wrestly children on the swing, laying upside down, doing bridges, doing cartwheels, flipping up and down. They're your vestibular seekers. But also you can have vestibular avoiders. So these are children that struggle to walk upstairs, that feel a bit unbalanced, struggle to sit back on their seat without, you know, looking back and looking a bit nervous and really feeling if the chair's there. They trip up, they fall, and they're a bit nervous and unbalanced. So via saying vestibular sensory issues, I wonder if they are seeking it or avoid it, or vestibular avoiders. I wonder if which one you mean there, but either way, I would, if they're seekers, I would be meeting that need regularly with regular sensory breaks that meet that. Upside down climbing, swing, nest swings are fantastic, rolling on the floor like sausage rolls, all of those kind of things to get that vestibular seeking, and then that will heighten them, so then do some grounding and calming afterwards before going back into class. If they are vestibular avoiders, so they're a bit nervous about that, then it is about spotting them and them slowly building their confidence. It's about having support systems in place, so like handrails, steady chairs, heavier furniture, so if they lean on them they don't wobble, all of those kind of things, and gradually walking around. It could also be linked with, if they're a bit unsteady, it might just not be just vestibular, it might also be vision as well, or proprioception. So for vision, you can masking tape or tape lines or spots to the ground to help with transition and guiding, and that might help them navigate their way when they're transitioning. If they've got proprioception needs, that is lots of grounding work. So maybe heavy things might help them feel a little bit more grounded in their bodies and to be able to walk, but also having lots of movement breaks. Again, deep pressure squeezes, jumping, anything that's hard that makes helps them to know where their body is, helps them feel it's centered in their body, because proprioception makes you not really sure if you're not, you know, looking where your arms are, where your legs are, and you feel a little bit woozy. So if anything kind of weight or grounding, jumping, tiptoe walking, clapping, all those kind of things that help you tell where your body is will probably help with their gross motor as well. What's the reason behind special education kids who scratch and bite in the early years? So scratching and biting is a classic get out of my space, because what do people do when you scratch and bite them? They don't want to play with you anymore. The way to support that is to give them a safer and more appropriate way of getting space. So it might be that you've created a space in the classroom, a little den. It could literally be a blanket over their table. It could be a pop-up dark den or a pop-up tent. It could be, like I was just saying earlier, about wall dividers. They've got their own safe space. It could be that's a safe space that they can go to at any time when they need to. Some children like outside as well. And then maybe having a visual as well of, I need a break, or I need space, and something that they can use and have on them, and that it's honoured. Because we'd way rather them communicate in that way than be scratching, biting, hitting, hair pulling. Another reason, and it's often linked with this, is they enjoy the cause and effect of it. They like the reaction. And it might be the only interaction they get with their peers, even though it's not a positive one. It still might be reinforcing and being meeting that social interaction need that they have. So it's also about modelling interactive games with their peers that are far more safe and appropriate, that they could play and initiate with them. Something like tag works really well because they're still having that grounding input of having impact on the child, but it's a known game and the child won't be offended by it and will reciprocate the game, and they can then play together. But that takes lots of adult modelling and support to do that with high support needs children. So yeah, have a look at those kind of things. It, again, the cause and effect as well. Maybe talk to your children not to have such a big reaction, which is so hard in early years, but certainly for the adults to not have such a big reaction on the negative or on the hurting behaviours. But have a really big and elaborate and exaggerated response to when the child initiates an interaction in a safer way, so that that cause and effect happens for more safe and appropriate behaviours. Just secured a role as a class teacher in an autistic base. Fantastic. Well, congratulations. Any tips for first time working in this setting? Yes, listen to your TAs. Your TAs will be your gurus because they will have worked with the children before, especially if you're starting, you know, from January. They'd have worked with them for at least 12 weeks, maybe even years before you step in. So don't feel like you have to walk in, stamp your feet, make your mark known, and, you know, and make changes. Listen to your staff. Listen to what's going well in the classroom, listen to what's not going well in the classroom, and work together collaboratively from that point on. There might be things after a few weeks that you want to initiate and embed in the classroom because you've seen things and you think of a better way of doing things or something you want to try. Then fantastic. But initially, when you first walk in, you're actually the student and they are the teacher, and you can just learn so much from them. My teaching assistants dragged me through the first year or two of my teaching when I first trained, and I learned so much. So yeah, go in with no ego and they will guide you through. Also, say yes to any training you're offered, even if it doesn't feel relevant at the time. It might be one day or with one student. So yeah, just say yes to every opportunity for training. Work closely with professionals that are within the school. So maybe you've got occupational therapists or physios or speech and language therapists or educational psychologists and nurses that you might be working alongside. So ask all the questions and just soak in all of their knowledge like a sponge. That's the only reason I know what I know. Hayley is here. Here's
Hello.
Hello! I'm so pleased you're here because I was doing my best to answer these early years questions. But the fact is, I said this right at the beginning, I've never worked in early years. So I know what good practice looks like for high support needs in a specialist provision. But that's why I want you here, because this really isn't my speciality and I really want to hear from you. You've had loads of posts recently about high contrast, about visual impairment, about sensory needs. So does that give a clue as to what your class is looking at like right now? Maybe explain a little bit about your class and what you do, because I know you've been in the space for a long time.
Yeah, definitely. So this cohort of children is kind of like no other. We are very much on learning, and I've just been watching you as well, so like learning what we're doing right now and taking all the advice that we can. So I have a particular child in my own class that is visually impaired, and they are blind. So there are lots of different, and again, I'm still learning, so many different types of visually impairment I never knew about. So my particular child has only got light perception. So if you imagined your eyes closed, that is then what they see. So they can see shadows and things like that. We also have another particular child in our cohort that is has a visual impairment. But again, that is why we are then looking at the high contrast and things like that. Okay. So they have nystigma as well as a couple of other things as well. So it's all about learning what we can and making those adaptations. And again, we all know what school budgets and things like that are like. So what can we change and what can we do that's kind of on the cheap and trying to work things out what we've already got right now?
It seems like you're really embracing it though, and actually, like, it seems like you're quite enjoying like this new skill that you're learning, which I love.
There's so many things. Like, I'm learning Braille at the moment and I've got no idea, you know. There's so many. I think when we teach like teachers and other people phonics, I think that we should teach them, you know, when you sit, well, when you see phonics, they always say, like, I have some squiggles on the screen. And then they sort of say, like, okay, so this squiggle means ah, and this squiggle means s. Right, read this sentence. And you're going to go, I don't know what that sentence right. means. But I actually think that they should use Braille instead, because, so there's, again, I'm just going to share what I know. There are six cells in Braille, and that's it. So we're using, Braille is very, very tiny. So we're using things like paint trays and tennis balls, egg cartons and ping pong balls and things like that to recreate the cells. And they all, where the cells are placed, where the balls are, means a different sound. Or it also links, like, is also number one. But you need the number character of Braille before then the number to know that that is one, not a. And just like all of that, I'm in a whole new world. That
the whole language, isn't it?
Yeah. And I'm just, you know, I just think teaching, you know, you never know everything. I always think you can just embrace more of what we learn about. And again, I'm still learning the things of these VI children and the VI team. We've got amazing support coming in to help us out. I didn't know that there's Braille Lego that you can get as well.
Exciting.
Yes. We've got Braille Lego, we've got, yeah, just so many different resources. I'm really excited. We've just ordered a chameleon reader. So it's a pen that you can get, and it's got stickers alongside it. So you can stick into any object, any book is what we're looking at doing, and then you record what's on that sticker. So then it means that the child will be able to feel for the sticker and click it along to the pen, and then they'll be able to embrace stories and reading a lot more. And also with that, they'll be able to build in those social skills to go and share a story with somebody else as well. So I think that's, again, a really important aspect that we're trying
to do. That's so great. And also embed in the love of learning, like you are with all your other, like your other students as well.
Yeah. I know you posted about the living paintings books as well recently.
I was going to say, have you accessed that?
Yeah, definitely. And like, there's a whole list on there and you can just access so many different things and have that whole inclusiveness as well. That this month is Blindness Awareness Month. So as a school, we've celebrated Blindness Awareness Month. I've done some assemblies on it. Every class is doing some different activities and learning about the children that we have in school and ensuring that we're just celebrating that. It can be as simple.
Thank you so much, because that is inclusion, isn't it? Like, everything you're describing is absolutely inclusion. It's not just making reasonable adjustments, which is what you're doing. It is celebrating the amazing world that is this, and not only within your class but in the whole school. It's so exciting to me to hear.
I just think that there's the main thing to take away from it is that anything that we're doing to support these children doesn't just support these children, it supports all children. Absolutely. So it can only benefit all the children that we have the high contrast. It only benefits all the children that we are exposing different, like we're adding scents to our Play-Doh and things like that. That can only support and help all the children as well.
Yeah, because some of your learners may not have visual impairment, but they might learn through touch or learn through doing, or, you know, be more physical learners, kinesthetic learners. So yeah, you're exactly right. Or might be like, find it easier to listen to the story or feel the story, or, you know, whatever. It's not going to hurt, is it?
Yeah, definitely.
So that's your visual impaired learners. Have you got any other complex needs or high support needs in your class as well?
Yeah, we do. So we have another particular child that has currently got an EHCP, but we're currently having a look at diagnosis with them. So we've got physios involved, OTs involved, speech and language involved, as we do, all the professionals that you take advice from, that we are probably going towards a cerebral palsy diagnosis, probably as well as other diagnoses as well. So again, learning from new, how to put on splints and things like that.
And lots of gross motor and fine motor stuff as well.
Yep. They currently don't walk as well, so we're in the process of trying to get them a wheelchair. We're in the process of trying to get them a standing frame.
This is what I was saying right before you came on. The early years, because they haven't necessarily got the HCP or they haven't got the diagnosis yet or they haven't got that support in place yet, they're not in specialist provision or whatever, you're in the trenches sometimes, aren't you, of like starting everything with also starting with parents. Like often by the time they come to us, the parents are so reassured and like know what their child is, has, whatever, that we don't ever have to have that conversation with the parent for the first time because they've been fighting for it for years before they even come to us. Do you know what I mean? Then all that shock factor, all of those conversations is kind of gone, whereas you are dealing with it like from the forefront, you like early years at the nursery and reception.
I think it's really hard as well because we've got these particular children that actually parents are really on board with and they're very accepting, and you know, how can we provide what they actually need, and we have these reasonable adjustments, but there are also children within our provision that actually might not be so on board, and actually we need to start that slow process of, you know, are they meeting developmental goals? And actually, we want the best for them. We're on the same team. And actually, what can we do to then support them, support you at home, and
how
work together?
And know that they're not reaching those milestones if there's nothing else, no one else to compare them to, right?
Yeah.
I've had parents before who have had a disabled older sibling, but have had no idea how disabled their younger sibling was, because in their comparison is relative, isn't it? So they were, you know, they're speaking, they're making, yeah, they do maths and reading. It's like they are working at 3 years below where they should, you know, but they just didn't know. So it's about having those conversations as well, isn't it? And kind of how.
And you just have to kind of sometimes just tread carefully and bring it up, and you know, use your like evidence within this. And sometimes it's quite good. I really dislike the typical like ages and stages of things, because you know, children don't all learn like that in one straight line. They do this, it doesn't work like that. So what I like to do is sometimes sit down with parents, take that all away, and sort of like hide those ages and stages and just go through with them, like, where do they think they're at and what are we seeing at school? So then we can then like take those ages and stages, then relook at them to then see, okay, so where is the child in ages and stages, and where are they actually showing us?
No, that's really helpful, because otherwise how would they know? That's really interesting. We had a question, it's a question I get a lot about continuous provision. I'm a firm believer in continuous provision. I'm an incredibly creative person, I totally get it, but I hear lots of teachers coming to me with, they have an autistic learner in their class, or one with, you know, sensory regulation needs, that finds it incredibly overwhelming to have, you know, everything out, or to have things out and there's lots of throwing, eating, tipping, pouring. Have you come across that, and how do you manage that within your room, and what are your thoughts around that? Because I have mine. So my advice was create a safe, you know, clutter-free environment for them to go back to and reset and go again. But I know it's not as easy. I've seen it. I'm attached to a mainstream school. I've seen children that tear displays, rip, pour, tip out. And it can be incredibly disruptive, can't it? So, and breaking children's work, you know, it can be really difficult. So have you seen it, and how, what do you do?
Absolutely. You know, in early years, you kind of, like you said before, you kind of see everything. You kind of see a bit of everything. So again, at this cohort right now, we've got a particular child who loves to rip things.
Right.
So it's about trying to what can they rip and what can't they rip? Mm. And then trying to teach that child of, if they start ripping, then bringing them over to that safe space of, this is where we can rip. And once they've got that particular rip that they are looking for, now we can come out and we can access that provision again.
Yeah.
Previously, I've had a child with picker before, so lots of eating, mouthing different objects and things like that. So again, I think it's really important to, when we look at things like messy and sensory play, is that appropriate for them? And I'm, yes, we need to be aware of poverty and food play and things like that as well. But actually, if our children are mouthing everything, what is safe for them and what isn't safe for them? And that balance between it. And one thing we did with that particular child, they used to like lots of like the little tiny like stones, like pebbles and rocks, and mouth those. And it was about finding something that we can trade out with them. Mm-hmm. So if they were to give you the rocks or anything, what's the texture like of a rock? So it's quite like solid and things like that. It could be quite crunchy.
Yeah.
So are they accepting that into a Cheerio? For example.
Yes, I was going to say dry cereal or something like that. Yeah.
What's acceptable, what's not? Is there something that actually, it needs to be of a similar texture. So it can't be completely something, if they're eating sticks, I'm not going to give them some jelly sort of thing. It's a completely different texture. It's probably what we've been advised about. What we've been advised about is ensuring that it's that similar texture, because that's what they're looking for, that sensory need of that. But we've had swiping off the tables and everything's gone. We've had, you know, ripping up children's work. And it's that, again, that understanding within your class of acceptance and children learn differently. And no, that's not okay that they've come and ripped your work or anything, but this child might need a little bit of extra help or anything, and it's okay.
So it's modelling that acceptance, isn't it, through your reaction, because your other children are going to be looking to you on how to react on this, aren't they? So validate their feelings, validate... You know, I know you worked really hard on that, and that's really sad that that's broken, isn't it? You know, and then start that conversation that way to validate them. But also, children are incredibly wise, actually, on difference, and they do get it. Even these in your class, don't they? They do get it. They see it, and they can be incredibly kind and generous with their forgiveness, can't they? But it definitely comes from adult modelling first. I think if adults are, even if they're trying to hide it, I think children are can read very acute emotions. And if you're underlying frustrated or anxious about something, I feel like they're going to pick that up and kind of replicate that as well and become frustrated and anxious themselves.
Yeah, I think it's just, you know, that, like you say, like validating their emotions, and then actually, oh well, never mind, let's make another one, you know, moving that on, something.
Yes.
How can we fix it?
Can I help you?
Yeah, should we get some tape, or what can we do to, you know, solve this problem now, and kind of looking at it then that way, but not skipping over that validations of emotions as well, because it is valid that actually something they've been working on for a long time has been destroyed.
Absolutely.
And it's okay if you're feeling sad, and it's okay, you know, if you're upset about that, how can we now change that around, sort of thing? Or should we put it back together and take a picture of it? Shall we photocopy it?
Oh, I love that.
Those sorts of things as well. So actually we've kind of recreated that image as well.
I really love that idea, because it makes it more permanent, doesn't it? And maybe take, if you know that a child rips, maybe taking a picture of it really quick.
Yeah.
You've got that evidence.
And we've had things like this particular child who loves to rip things, like displays and things like that. And I know you've shared before, like using material and things like that. Another thing that we've done is use like a PVC plastic over the top of boards and Velcroed it.
Yes,
so actually,
if
the backing will be safe if it's material, but actually the work on it, that could get ripped as well. So actually we pull down the plastic behind it, put the paper and displays up, and then put the plastic. Because if then that child rips it, that's Velcro that they're ripping, and we can just easily stick that back down. Nothing's broken, nothing's got damaged. Yep, there we go.
That's a really great idea. And also children that, I don't know, spray water, or you know, spray their drink or whatever, it's just safe from all of those those wet materials as well, isn't it?
All those little icky children.
I love it. It's never boring, is it?
No day is the same. Absolutely.
It. Somebody has said, have you got any top tips for a trainee in a non-subject specific class? So I can imagine it's very, I mean, that is what early years is, isn't it? It's all subjects can be met with every activity, pretty much, can't it?
Yeah.
So what does that look like as far as like what your day looks like, and what kind of activities do you kind of are your every go-to activities, I suppose?
So I always think that we kind of go with our strengths. So I love maths. I'm dyslexic. So I think one and one always will add two, but the whole like E before I before E, except after C, but not in this word or that word or that one, doesn't make sense to me. So right. I'm always drawn to, you know, the maths learning and things, because I think it's very hands-on, it's very tactile. We can, you know, explore in different ways and things like that. Quite creative and fine motor I like as well, because I'm a big believer in ensuring that we've got the skills before writing. So yeah. I do a lot of work with our parents and with teaching the parents that actually how to help them write isn't by sitting down and getting them to write letters and letters and letters. It's actually by going to the park and riding a bike and going on a scooter and all of those big arm muscle movements, first of all, and then bringing it to the fine motor movement.
Is that a common problem? Because I have in-laws and siblings with three-year-olds, and they are obsessed with pencils, writing, and I'm like, no, don't play in mud, you know. Use pegs, play in the kitchen. Don't do that. You don't need to do that yet. You know, do dances and practice moving your body.
Absolutely. I think it's just a typical thing that people associate school with, sitting down and writing and learning in that sense. It's a lot of the work that we do when the children first start, and we have our meeting coming up really soon. All the way beginning of next year's cohort, we then have a meeting in May, we then have one in September, once those children have their places. But again, starting it from that point of, in our school, in early years, we are play-based. What does that actually mean? You know, it's not that we have, they just, what do you do all day? I just play. Because, of course, that's what your children are going to do. They don't know that they're actually learning these skills or practicing these skills that they're actually doing. Everything we have out has a purpose for their learning. And it's so cross-curricular as well. Nothing is just, this is maths and this is only going to be maths. So it's all so many different cross-curricular, and it's kind of teaching the parents that, and that is still learning. We give them a whole list of different activity ideas that they can do that is learning in maths, that is learning in writing and things like that as well. Yes, we obviously have phonics lessons. The children take home little phonics cards so they can practice that. And again, we have an activity pack that goes home with every child. And it is not, you know, sitting down, what's this flashcard? What's this flashcard? What's this flashcard? Absolutely. Yes, they are mini sounds, but actually, go and put them on the stairs and then stamp on the stairs as you go along. Put them in different corners and then can you run to the at sound? Can you run to the sound? And the sound splat. And I always say, like, get the children to teach you as much as you teach the children. Because 100%, like, we've all had to learn phonics. I had to learn phonics when I was training to be a teacher. I didn't know it before. And I'm not assuming that parents know that either.
Right. Yeah, so their children are the experts, really, aren't they? And otherwise they could have some, like, difficult practice. On this, on all these cross-curricular amazing ideas, I can see your book behind you. Do you want to do a little pluggy plug of your book, which looks incredible, by the way? So you've broken it down into the cross-curricular subject, the earlier subjects, haven't you?
Yes. So this is my book. It's called Play All The Way. It's available on Amazon. And in it, it kind of shows you my journey. So my journey, I was a nursery nurse. I've been a one-to-one TA. I've been a TA. I then trained to be a teacher. I did my degree whilst working full time. And then I was in nursery in my current school. And then I moved through to foundation. Took over as early years lead 3 weeks before lockdown. So that was an interesting time. And then I've been in foundation since. So I've been teaching only 7 years, but I've got like quite a big range of different experiences within early years during that time. And it kind of goes through my journey. It breaks down really what's the statutory framework, what's not statutory framework. It then goes into the areas of learning. And of course, I love a rainbow. So everything is colour coded.
I love it.
So you can easily see that if you want an activity idea that's PSED, you can go to the red section, and then all of those activity ideas
are to do with PSED. So if you want communication and language, it's orange. If you want physical development, it's yellow. Because again, my dyslexic brain just works like that.
I love that. I love it.
It just makes sense to me.
I love that. And there's loads of pictures in there of your actual activities, isn't there? It's all broken down really easy. So if there's any early years teachers or trainees that are struggling to think of ideas, you know, you're going for the flashcards, you're going for the pencils and paper, and you're not really, you know, you're mind boggled and a bit overwhelmed by Pinterest because sometimes there is just too much choice, and actually it's not realistic, let's face it, it's actually for the photos and not for the children, then this book would be perfect, wouldn't it? Because it's all broken down and it's real. You're actually doing these things. So you
I'm all about just recreating those like really simple but effective learning ideas. It doesn't need tons of resourcing. It doesn't need loads of expensive things as well. It's about recreating these activity ideas, something that you can just pick up and use as inspiration. You don't have to recreate the same thing. Of course you can do, but you can take it when you're just a bit stuck that day and you're thinking, oh, I don't really know what to do around this learning objective. Oh, I'll pick up this book, flick through it. Oh, that's a great one. Right, I'm going to take this element of it, but change it into this sort of part instead. So again, yeah.
Sometimes you just need that starter, don't you? Because often, well, especially like first thing on a Monday or last thing on a Friday, you have nothing left and certainly no creative flair left. Sometimes I just stare into the abyss and just hope that something comes to me. And it rarely does, and I have to just go home and sleep on it. But if you grab that book, then at least, you know, you're not starting from scratch and you can think, oh yeah, of course I could do that. And then start creating that way.
Absolutely. I just think Pinterest is so overwhelming. And like you say, it's not realistic. We're not going to be creating these. Of course, we all have wonderful classrooms. But the reality is, if only I could bring my phone into school and show you what an actual day looks like or what my classroom looks like during provision time. Of course, there's toys on the floor and there's scissors left over here and there's bits of paper everywhere, because this is a really realistic classroom. So it's things that you can actually pick up and do, whether that's at home or whether that's at school as well. They're really easily, you can recreate them really easily. Yeah.
As I was talking about Pinterest and the whole social media side of things, you've been on social media for a while, haven't you? Because yep. I remember following you from years ago. Do you know what you were doing when you started?
I started in 2018.
So, yeah.
I was an NQT when I started. So I actually started because when I joined my school, there was no early years leader. Mm-hmm. And I was an NQT in nursery. In foundation, there was an NQT and a teacher who had been there 1 year. And we were kind of just in there and off you go. So I was setting up different activities and things like that. And I was like, I don't know if these are good activities. Are the children going to like them? Are they not? Am I going to remember them? So I just started taking pictures with my phone. And I was like, yeah, this is a good one, keep this one. If it didn't work, delete that one. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of got a bit fed up with them all on my stored on my phone. So that's actually why I started Instagram. And I was like, at least they can be stored there. I can look back over
that's
them.
Brilliant.
But yeah, it's been a great journey.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I think mine was kind of similar, but I felt like no one ever came into my sensory room. And I was putting in all of this effort and none of the parents ever saw it. Because we weren't doing iPad photos or evidence at that time. So none of them saw it. None of the SLT cared enough to come in. None of my colleagues were coming in. I thought, I'm putting in all this effort. I want to share it with someone for a bit of a pat on the back.
Absolutely.
I did a similar thing. I was taking photos of stuff anyway. But I was like, I want people to see this because I think this is a really good idea. And I want to get the praise. Looking back, that's what it was. That was in 2015. So similar time to you, really. And yeah, that was called Our Sensory Kids back then. It's Sensory Classroom now. But yeah, I did it. I did it genuinely just so that people could tell me what a good job I was doing. So much effort and time and money and resources and energy into it that I knew it was brilliant for the kids, but they're non-speaking, so they couldn't tell me how amazing I was. And then of course it snowballs, and actually there are so many benefits, aren't there? Because I was never expecting the community that
you received. Like Teachergram was a thing. It was only when I joined and then, oh, I followed that person and then more people come up and then, you know, it sort of builds and things like that. And I just think it's this amazing, incredible place. And it's one of the first places that I always say to people. So I, in my school, also lead all of the teacher training and all of the ECTs in my school too. It's one of the first places I say, like, have a look on Instagram. Instagram will give you realistic Pinterest, basically, is what I call it.
Yeah.
So You can search hashtags, you can, if you know a certain account and things like that, obviously you can look them up, but you can search a topic, you can search, you know, if you want a particular fine motor skills, or if you want a particular bonfire night activity, and just look through all of those pictures. Again, I'm quite a visual learner, so I need those visual pictures to be like, oh yeah, that works really well, or oh, I really love that, but that wouldn't work in my classroom.
I think that's why Instagram works so well, particularly, is because it is so visual, isn't it? It is picture or video first. And I feel like the people that go into teaching, especially those early years or special education stages, I feel like they're incredibly creative and practical and like to do and create and make. And I feel like Instagram like scratches that itch perfectly, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just grown into one of those things that I'm so incredibly grateful for. Obviously, we had lockdown. That's where I grew even more. I've been able to work with fantastic brands. I've been able to write my book now. I've been able to build a business with my teacher best friend and everything, and just support those teachers around us and things. And I just think, again, sometimes you might not want to speak to somebody in your school because you might feel a little bit embarrassed or something, but talking and reaching out to somebody that you kind of don't know, but actually, right, I'm just going to reach out and ask those questions. I'll always try and get through my DMs and help people if I can do and things like that. And it's just because I would want that of somebody as well. So if I wanted to ask a question, I would want somebody to be able to reach out back
and
to
me. We've all been there, haven't we? We've all been for that first interview. We've all done an NQT, or it was called an NQT year then, which is my ECT year. We've all done, like, we've all been there. So there's no silly questions, because once we didn't know this either. And actually, also, I am learning so much from being on here. My practice has improved so much since I've been sharing again. I only started this new account in Christmas, so less than a year. And my God, my practice has improved massively, because I'm be able to learn from such experts in the field all across the world and take little bits. It's like being on training, like whenever I'm on my phone. It's incredible. I absolutely love it.
I still call like social media, this is like CPD time as well for me, because you're taking those experts and you're looking at watching a video, or you're taking some ideas, or you've read a little something on the caption or something that's and you've asked a question, or you've reached out to somebody else and it turns into this conversation. And we're not experts in everything, but we can have our own little expertise, but actually learn from each other. I think that's what Instagram does so well, with Teachergram sort of thing, teachers on here and sharing ideas and that community. It's not a competition, and it's, you know, sharing all of our ideas.
And lots of, you know, year two to year six teachers have SEN in their classroom. So they will be looking to early years teachers or looking to special education teachers for ideas, because that's where those learners in their class are at. You know, they learn in that practical, creative way. Well, year four, five, six teachers aren't used to thinking in that way. So they're going to be looking, aren't they, for ideas. And that's where we're happy to help them, aren't we?
Yeah, definitely. And it's just, it is, because your early years people in these schools are the ones that have so many different creative ideas, and it's go and visit them, go and have a look what they do, because early years is just like this unique place that actually is unlike usually any other, unless you do provision in year one and year two. But what is provision? Lots of teachers don't understand what provision is and what the children are actually doing. They just see that as like they're just independent, they're just playing. They don't get the whole purpose behind it and the thoughts and the considerations we've had to do. I always say provision is so much harder to teach in than like if I was to sit down and teach my phonics lesson.
Completely. Oh my God, if you were just to lead structured group sessions, it would be way less time and energy, wouldn't it? And so much easier to control and manage. And yeah, it's definitely not the easy way out.
Yeah.
Definitely. That's by far, I can totally say that.
But it, leaders don't know necessarily what their subject looks like in early years.
True.
I always suggest that an early years teacher, an early years person should go with their subject leader and go and explain that to them. But don't just explain it in the staff room. Go and show them that in practice as well. So the things that you might be seeing in science could be this, it could be this, it could be this. Or you think, let's go and have a look, and then talk them through what you're actually seeing, because they won't see what history looks like in early years unless they're going to sit there and see an input.
So in some schools then, if they're a subject leader, would they be expected to do the long-term or medium-term plans for early years? Or usually is that down to you guys?
They do.
Yeah, so my school works a little bit differently in that. But yeah, a typical school would be you would have a subject and you would do that from early years until year six.
Right.
Which I think is just crazy because as an early years person, I have no idea what they're learning in year six. I don't want to tell them, just the same as I don't want them to tell me how to run right. my early years.
And you would think
that would be the most, I get it, because then you can see the progression. Like, that's why, obviously why they're doing it, because they want there to be a clear linear progression from early years to year six. But you also want really high quality teaching and as higher expectations as you can offer for all yeah. children, don't you? So that, it would make sense to me that you would work together. I mean, we're so separate and self-contained in my room. That actually I just do all of it. I just do the whole curriculum. But yeah, it would be good. We should work more in my class, in my school, because obviously there's SEN all throughout the school. So there's no reason why they couldn't then access what I'm doing. Like, that door's just like, there just seems to be like a wall up, but it's something I'm working on. It's something I'm trying to bang, crash down.
It's really hard, isn't it?
It's strange, isn't it?
It's hard because people don't want it, but it's the unknown as well. Mm. If I cross this line of like little children that like might touch me even, and like they come and just stand there like what are they doing?
It's so true. If I ever get asked to like supply or cover year five or six, I'm like, I can't do that. They don't sing nursery rhymes. I wouldn't know what to do.
But I need to do it my way, okay?
Oh my god, I would end up, they just look at me like, what are you doing? Because I'm like pulling something exciting out of my bag or whatever.
I think they'd still love that though. I think everybody's got this inner child that they would still be engaged, they would still love that. And I think that's kind of what's missing from older year groups, even.
Yeah, maybe.
But yeah,
maybe.
Yeah, our school works completely differently. So we have like teams of people. So we have a curriculum person on the early years team. We have a couple of curriculum people on the Key Stage 1 team and a couple of people on the Key Stage 2 team. They then work together on curriculum of our school. So then, for example, if the big O was to come, they would all be brought into that meeting to talk through how it progresses from early years into Key Stage 1, into Key Stage 2, and it goes on. We're an all through school into secondary as well, so even we had to talk through what year 6 looks like into year 7, and then they go and explore obviously
secondary. So what are that your age range then in your school?
So we're over two sites. So we've got a primary site and a secondary site. Right. We do have a nursery, but once they get their foundation place, so once they're into four, they can be with us. They don't have to apply for another school until they're into sixth form.
Wow.
That's
incredible. I didn't even know they existed.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we've got different other teams. So we've got like a pastoral team. Again, that's split between the different key stages. So that's pastoral, so safeguard and behaviour. We've got another SEND inclusion team. So again, that's split between the different key stages. And it just means that it just seems a lot more coherent. I haven't got a year six teacher telling me how to teach computing or something like that. I'm like, you don't know what 4 years olds need to know. And I don't know what they need to know.
Right. And then it just ends up a bit blah, doesn't it? Because you're not inspired. You don't know.
Yeah,
that makes sense. That does make sense. I feel like from what you've said, I think my main student do it, like one person is just the maths lead and they do it for the whole school. So that's interesting.
Because I think...
Yeah, I've never really understood it.
Yeah, I think it's really, really important because does that person... Well, one, usually you're given a subject. It doesn't matter if you really like that subject or not. It's, you could be going into a new school and you're given maths, but actually I don't really like maths and I don't know what I'm doing or something. Like if I was given English as an example, I wouldn't know what they need to be learning and I don't feel confident in the subject. So why would I feel confident going to tell each different year group what they need to be teaching and going to monitor that? Are they doing the right thing? Is our curriculum right? Do I want to bring in a different scheme? Yeah, because I wouldn't even have the first idea. It's not something that you do in teacher training. It's not something that you do in your ECT years or anything. You're just kind of put in a school and kind of expected to know those things.
Yeah, it's true. It's really true. I remember when I first started, I almost fought for to be leader in the creative subjects. So I was like, it's all I know. I do dance, art and drama. I can do those ones.
Yeah, subject leaders, you have quite often more than one subject. So you're not only leading like just maths, you might be leading maths and you might be leading computing and science or something like that. And you think, like we're not experts in everything. How can we be experts in those subjects as well as if we're teaching early years?
Yeah. Yeah, it's so true, and yet that ask is often on teachers, and it's such a big workload, isn't it, to add on to what already is a lot of work, isn't it?
Yeah, it really depends on the school as well, what the expectation is of subject leadership and things. But I'm very happy the way that we do things
Yeah, it
at
sounds
my school with
good.
that. It kind of makes sense. It kind of uses people in their expertise in what they feel passionate about as well. We do lots of peer observations on each other as well. And my part of that is not only part of curriculum as well as somebody else, but also part of leading the ITT and ECT stuff as well. So I'm sort of a lone wolf in that. But sort of, again, I get other people, I would take them on learning walks around the school and what am I seeing in different people, and then talk through a lesson of somebody. But I think that's really important, that sharing of knowledge and
Yeah,
things.
definitely. And picking that specialist thing, I guess, is it quite a big school? Is it like a how
Three
many?
form entry.
Yeah, so
Yeah.
as is like one and a half sometimes, or even, one and a half form entry. So that would be difficult, wouldn't it? I feel like maybe
Yeah.
that's why.
Yeah,
It's
so
funny, isn't it, how schools work so incredibly different, like from literally 5 minutes down the road. It would be just completely different curriculum, completely different subjects, how it works.
And even we're part of a trust, even within our trust, we've got different phonics schemes. We've got somebody else teaching differently to their year six because we're teaching not to SATs, we're teaching to our secondary school, and we want them for long-term success and things. So even within that, even though that tends to be all of our trust schools will go to our secondary school, people still have different curriculums.
And then interesting, it'd be interesting to see the data on that, wouldn't it? About the phonics schemes and, like, if there's an overall one. What phonics scheme do you use?
Read writing.
Do you? Yeah, it's standard, isn't it? Yeah,
Yeah, mixed
exactly.
feelings there, but yeah,
I
read writing.
agree. I support phonics for Key Stage 2 as well as part of my school. And for the dyslexic students who read, write, ink still hasn't worked for when they're year four, five, six. There's just certain students that often they're sight readers, that they're not progressing. They progressed initially and then they didn't progress past year one or two. And I'm working with those with a dyslexia company to kind of unpick that and find other ways that they might like to learn. And it's so interesting, like seeing the mainstream Key Stage 2 children that way, because I would never work at that stage or level. So it's been really interesting that to work at that part of SEND really, and work out all the different reasons why they might not be reading. But it does seem to be the flavor of the month, doesn't it? But I know when I trained it was all about Jolly Phonics, and then it was all
Yeah.
about Little Wandle, and the Letter Land was before that. There's always a flavor, isn't there? And there'll be something else
Yeah.
as
There's
well.
pros and cons, obviously, to different schemes and things like that. A definite pro is there's set routines. Every lesson is exactly the same, but it does mean that once you're trained, I can go into any lesson of any book, any level, and I can go and teach that. So it means for a cover sense, if I'm out of class, that I know I can leave, I don't have to get all different resources and talk through the lesson. They know how to cover that. Pros and cons as well with that, because each session is the same, it reduces the cognitive load of that. But for me, also, it's quite boring because you're teaching the same thing, and like the same routines and the same dates, just a different sound, for example, and things. But yeah, we can make it a bit more fun and exciting. We have to stay to the scheme, but
Phonics is an interesting one in my room. I've tried all sorts with my autistic learners. Typically, they learn through phrases or whole words, like that's what they naturally want to do. And a couple of them have progressed through with phonics, but lots haven't. I've just been doing lots of experimenting over the last like 4 or 5 years, trying Jolly Phonics, thinking, oh, the actions and the songs, maybe that will entice them. And they really like the actions and the songs, but it didn't help them read. And so there was that. And then we did sensory stories through phonics, and that was again fun and got their engagement. But again, it didn't help them to read. And then I did a bit of read, write, ink, but through made my own interactive games to do with the sound, and again they enjoyed it, but it didn't help them read. And now I've just succumbed to, I'm going to teach them. Why am I slogging teaching them how other children learn? No, I should actually just teach them how they learn. So we've gone whole words, we've gone phrases, we've gone, you know, and sight words, core words, and I'm seeing some really good progress. So maybe I should have just listened to myself. I'm mixed in with phonics though, because I'm still an advocate for phonics first. I can see why only learning 44 sounds to read everything helps completely. But also, like, if they don't learn or hear in that way and think in that way, then it's really difficult, isn't it?
Yeah.
To assume that they would. It's, you know, teaching somebody with visual impairment, I know we started talking about that at the beginning, how a sighted person would see. Well, it's not going to work like that. They're autistic and maybe their brain just, you know, processes language and learning differently. But I'm really enjoying learning about it.
Yeah.
I think that's the best thing about teaching, isn't it? You're just constantly learning.
And I think it's okay. And I think even more so in early years than any other year groups, that it's okay to experiment with that. That it's okay, I'm going to try this. Is that working? Reflect on that. No, it's not okay. Let's try something else. I think almost within Key Stage 1, Key Stage 2, it becomes a little bit more trickier to be able to experiment a little bit more. But I think that's important to work out what works for you, what works for the children, how different children then learn. And it's the same as if you walk into a classroom. I have quite a noisy classroom and I'm quite like a loud person. That doesn't suit everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to learn to, you know, with some children I have to be a little bit more quieter and, you know, talk softer to them. Other children we can jump around and be really noisy with them.
Yeah.
And that suits their learning style. You can go into some classrooms and it completely dead silent because that's the way the teacher likes it and that's their expectations. For me, it's not my typical classroom. My typical classroom is organised chaos that's going on. Lots of laughter, lots of fun, lots of, you know, learning and playing and all of those things. Yes, of course, those routines and those boundaries are still in place. But we have different expectations and that's okay. Yeah. And different children learn in different ways, obviously.
Yeah, and that's what's good about having lots of different teachers, because you'd hope between early years and year six, they've had a few teachers that match their style. And I know it's really frustrating for parents when you don't get the teacher you wanted or whatever, because you can see how it would match. And I get it, and I've felt it as a student as well. And I've certainly seen my friends and colleagues feel that around teachers for their children. And I do get it, it's quite an anxious time, isn't it? But just know that the majority, you know, from early years to year six, there will be teachers that just match your child that little bit better, and just because of their learning style. And that's nothing to do with a choice. It just is. Just like we get on with certain people better and we just think better with others.
Yeah, I think it's just so important that so much goes into that as well. It's not just a drawn from the hat, being a 3-4 entry school and having 90 children in my class, in our cohort. It's not just a pick from the hat, right, that one's going to that class and that one's going to that class. There's friendship, there's like ratios to have a look at, there's the level of need, who would get on better with that teacher, there's different friendships we have to be aware of, there's behaviour, there's so much that goes into those. Or okay, that looks good, let's put them together. And when you put them together and actually see them in front of you,
No, that doesn't work. I know, I've seen it. Sometimes, like, you know, you have the practice run, like, you know, you do little, like, meet the teacher or whatever, and they're like, this cannot work. Like, why did we think this was a good idea? Let's switch that out.
You think you've perfected it, and you're like, yeah, this is set. It goes to the parents, you have your transition day. You're like, yeah, it's all going to be good. September starts. Within the first week, they've made new friends, and there's all different parts that should be together. But it's the way it goes.
Yeah, that's so true. Luckily, I don't have that problem. I have my kids for 7 years. They just don't leave my room.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's quite intense, actually, because obviously you get to know them so well and the family so well after 7 years. It's, like, incredible, isn't it? So, yeah, it's very different. And with my classroom, so it's 10 children, but ranges from early years to year six, those 10 children. So we'll always have like somebody leaving, but also a couple coming. Like, it's kind of like a flow. There's never everybody starting and everybody leaving. And I quite like it because it definitely helps with the transition, because we can embed routines really quickly because all of the others are modelling for that new student like, what to do. And also saying goodbye after 7 years is so hard. I think I would actually die of a broken heart if all 10 were to leave at the same time. It would be horrendous. We had to say goodbye to 4 randomly last year out of 10. And that was honestly heartbreaking, saying goodbye to them all. So all at once. So it works really well for us, is having that kind of constant flow.
It's so interesting, like you said, about how so many different schools can just be up the road from each other and work completely different, whether that's their, like,
how they support their SEND children, how they do their curriculum, what phonics scheme they follow, all of those different things.
Yeah, exactly. Couldn't be more different. Right, we are going to have to end this now. Hayley, people need to know where to follow you, plug all your stuff. And yeah, because I think there's lots of people here that have some fantastic questions. And I think your knowledge is really useful for all of special education parents, if you're working in early years, and if you are planning a curriculum for early years within your school, then I think it would be really great to know your stuff. So yeah, where can people find you?
So you can find me on Instagram, lots of different social medias, all about early years. I have the book that I have just published. It's called Play All The Way. It's available on Amazon. I also have a business called The Powerful Play Teachers, in which it's a membership club, and sell resources on there. And there's video training videos and resources to support teachers through their teacher training, through you can be a qualified teacher, you can be an unqualified teacher, a nursery nurse, a childminder. You can be an experienced teacher of so many years, and there's bits on there for everybody. There is available a little free trial on there as well. So come and check it out, come for give me a follow. DMs are always open if you want to chat. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. I have absolutely loved having you, and I'm so excited to chat with you more in the DMs about lots of ideas for my class. Thank you so much.
Super. Bye.
Bye.